Hello everyone, you're listening to the Highlander Cast, the official podcast of the 7-point Highlander format. I'm one of your usual hosts, Saab. Vance is not with me today, and actually I'm not here either. I'm actually only doing the recording of the intro for this episode. As you'll be familiar with from our previous episode, we're looking at trying to release some content in the interim until we can get the feet of the podcast underneath us during these COVID times and get into some sense of regularity again. So for now, we're going to be doing a bit of a deep dive with some guest stars. You'll be familiar with from the previous release a discussion that I had with Dan Abraham and Drew Carter. This was a collaborative effort as we released that on the Adelaide Eternal YouTube page. And then we decided, why don't we release this on the podcast as well? Because sometimes people just prefer to listen to content in an audio format or in the convenience of their own home in their car when they're listening to something whilst cutting vegetables for dinner or whatever it might be. So perhaps this might be the way that you're engaging with us, and that's great. So we're not charging for these episodes. They're really just another opportunity to get more Highlander content both on the podcast and also out to your homes via different media. So this particular episode is Dan Abraham and Drew Carter talking all about cantrips. Now, they actually wax lyrical for about an hour and a half here in what is really a detailed deep dive into the nature of cantrips in Highlander. It's really fascinating. So they go into detail on what cantrips are used for, what are cantrips, what are they by definition, and the history and theory of cantrips in magic in general, and then apply that philosophy to Highlander. So if you are a Highlander aficionado, you've played your fair share of cantrips and blue control decks and pretty much any decks with blue nowadays, and you're wondering, what's that threshold? What's the cutoff? Once you do your brainstorm, preordain, and ponder, at what point is a cantrip too weak? At what point are cantrips auto-includes? And then looking at it from even broader perspectives on the roles of those cantrips and how you can do the same or achieve the same kind of goals in decks where you don't have blue, you don't have the liberty of access to Brainstorm and Friends. So if you're interested in listening to more about magic theory and then how to apply that theory to your own Highlander decks and your own Highlander brewing, then this is going to be the kind of episode for you. And I'll leave you in the trusty hands of Dan Abraham and Drew Carter to take you through cantrips in 7-point Highlander. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another chat with Dan Abraham. Dan, how are you going?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Drew. How are you? Coming on from our last foray into the metagame. We're going to do another one.
Yeah, we thought we had a few different topics to chat about. And well, I could ask you what you think about the metagame and the decks you've been working on and what you think's good, but I think we should say that for another time. So it's a big topic.
Yeah, it's true. But yeah, I think today we're going to have a chat about cantrips that you can play in Australian Highlander. So I'm looking forward to that. It's something we talk about often. Between ourselves, so we thought we might share some of our thinking around that.
Yeah, and I think the topic of cantrips is fascinating in general in terms of magic theory, so I'm keen to pick up on that as well. Like, so first we should say, well, what is a cantrip? What do you think a cantrip is?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's usually a spell that says draw a card, draws a card, usually for a low mana investment. So they're usually one or zero mana, and have some sort of minor effect. It's kind of how I think about it. Yeah, and so, you know, it's usually one mana blue spells, but there are examples of cantrips and other, you know, other colors and artifacts. That's kind of how I think about it. Yourself?
Yeah, well, I think you're right. In magic parlance, you can say this card cantrips, and it just means it draws a card or it replaces itself. So I think that's a fair and valid use, and that makes sense. But if we talk about cantrips and why you would want to play cantrips, I think of it as something that offers selection. So it increases your options. It allows you to choose one or another card to replace itself. Yeah, so it doesn't gain you card advantage. It's kind of card neutral. It just replaces itself, but it crucially offers selection. So it offers you to choose one card or another. That's what I think of the importance of cantrips. Like, because Patrick Chapman who I often quote, but he influenced my thinking and our thinking a lot. He wrote an article trying to bring it, all these theoretical insights together around magic. And he ultimately, I think, went too far because he said that magic's ultimately about options. And the goal of a game of magic is to remove your opponent's option of continuing to play the game, not by killing them. I think goes too far, but I think options, yeah, are important. They and there's another article which drew attention to a documentary on artificial intelligence and how it kind of solved Go, or not didn't solve it, but how it became the best Go player, which is like a Japanese or game of some or heritage like that. AlphaGo is the docker, and it's really good, but this article emphasized how AlphaGo, it seems to just prefer moves which gave it the most options.
Yeah.
So like getting options in Magic, it seems to be important in terms of converting, in terms of winning advantages in tempo, card advantage, life, or whatever else matters in that context. So having options is important. And I see cantrips as, in the history of Magic, as really perhaps the first discovery around the importance of selection as a means of increasing your options.
Yeah, that's interesting. That strikes me as a very like blue player, like oriented way of thinking about the game. Do you know what I mean? So like you're looking to play spells as late as possible, be able to make choices based on best information as possible. Whereas like, I don't know, if I think about like say decks like Junk or what have you, where you just want to, you don't really care, you want to just be on curve and just like jamming into, you don't really care, you kind of jam into counter magic. So like, I think that's definitely their function, but it's interesting to think that that's, I mean, blue is obviously a very dominant color for in magic generally. Like maybe that's the reason, is it has that strategic edge because it's against to preserve its options. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think, I'm not talking just about preserving options. I think other colors, you don't have to play blue to have options because Knight of Autumn has options. You know, you can choose to gain life, make it big, or destroy something. There's lots of ways to get options, but so maybe, yeah, maybe there were always cards like Mishra's Factory, I'll talk about later. It's a card that can give you a mana or it can be a creature. There's an option there baked into the card itself. But cantrips are a way to like create options through card selection. Yeah, that's how I see it. And they are, you should think of blue when I say that, because yeah, like often you can jump from cantrips to like the blue cantrips. There are a few green ones now, but you know, cantrips are like synonymous with little blue one drops instance, or you know, sorceries, you know, somewhat. But we'll have a look at some notable cantrips in a minute. But yeah, I think I may be broadening the topic a bit, but I'm thinking about Xerox. So Xerox was a strategy that everyone copied, and that's why it got the name, because it was so successful. And what it did was it took out lands and put in lots of like brainstorm and preordain effects or ops or something like that. And it played like eight or more of these effects instead of and what it noticed was that it could play fewer lands because you had the option through these cards of getting lands in the early game. But you could also reduce, so you could play fewer lands, still not get mana screwed. But in the late game, you could get really rewarded by top decking better because you got fewer lands, but also using your selection, your cantrips, to filter away your lands, even the fewer lands that you do see. So the early game was just as consistent, if not more consistent, and the late game was more consistent because it had better top decks. And so it just dominated because of that. And everyone copied it overnight. And so that for me is how I understand. And in a way, that's, Rich Shea wrote an article saying like that's the way to play magic. Like that's just proven historically the best way to play magic. And there's only a few other strategies that can punish that way of playing magic. Yeah. Like you can tax the cantrips or go over the top with something huge. So I think part of the function of a cantrip is you want to get to give you mana early and business late. That's part of the
fun. I agree with that.
We'll get to that later though. And we'll see if there are any other ways of achieving that.
I also think there's like an interesting characteristic of them that like it's rarely a free effect. you know, you are investing some tempo, so some mana in choice. Mm. And so there is like, it's not like it's a cost-free exercise. Like Cataxian Probe is probably the one that comes closest to being like free-ish, or even like some of the baubles that we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But you know, sometimes the tempo loss that comes with cantrips has a real cost, like particularly if you're facing down an aggro deck or something like that. So
yeah,
I agree. Like the choice is very powerful, but it's not cost-free. I guess
it's not free. No, it's generally not. You need to pay mana, and that's big. That's the big loss in tempo, because you're not impacting the board. You're not gaining life. You're not gaining card advantage. All you're doing is increasing your options. So that better pay you back at some point, because you are losing a resource in terms of mana. And so, yeah, like, and maybe that means that maybe that's why there's not too many 2 and 3 mana cantrips just offering selection, because cost then just becomes too hard to recoup.
Yeah, it sort of ties up, you know, when you're playing a format with the speed of Australian Highlander, like if you're starting to pay more than 1 mana or 0 mana for this kind of effect, you're really like almost time walking yourself. You know, it can cost you a turn just because your mana is too compressed by the effect. But yeah, should we have a look at some common ones?
Yeah. I just want to say one more thing. Oh, and I think the next, so we talk about Xerox, and I think I should probably save this till we look at the cards, but I think one of the next, a part of the evolution of Highlander that I've noticed is that if we talk about Xerox as the way to play, I don't necessarily agree with that, but it's a powerful way to play. That loss of tempo, you're investing mana in to increase your options. But the brokenness of like what Delve does in terms of like Gurmag and Tasiga and things like that is it pays you back that lost mana. You can then use your cantrips in the graveyard as mana. So that when you can do that, when you use your cantrip to give you selection at the cost of mana, but then recoup the mana through the Delve mechanic, you're just getting the best of everything. You're getting the selection is almost free because you're getting the mana back. And that's why, as we've seen in the last, I think, year, a lot of like rug tempo and just Delve threats just doing really well, even despite the prevalence of bounce in the format and stuff.
Yeah, it's what makes like the printing of Murktide Regent so astounding, right? Because we knew this. And that's why. Like even before its printing, like Gurmag had done well in Legacy just because you could just fill your graveyard and then like say, oh, can you answer this 5/5? That's big. Like you can kill you within short time if your opponent's playing a bunch of fetch lands and they probably functionally start the game on 15 life. Like it's a quick clock.
Really. Yeah. So maybe let's look at some cards and then we'll think about why play cantrips and why. Why maybe not to play cantrips, or what are the other ways of playing? If the cantrips are so good, why are we not playing them? And what do we get if we avoid them or whatever? So I'll share a screen. So Dan's highlighted some cantrips. Can you see that?
Yeah, I can see that one.
All right. So this is your selection. So you put Acorn there. Why'd you do that?
Oh, because it's fun. It draws a card at least. You know, it's one mana. It costs you some tempo, but it draws a card. I mean, obviously the card's a complete bomb. It's 5 points. It's not, you know, there's no other card in that list that's in the same league as Ancestral Recall, but, you know, it does invest mana to draw a card or more. It's shown to be perhaps the most powerful card in history of the game.
But so does Brain Geyser. Why didn't you put Brain Geyser?
I think like we were talking earlier about the mana investment that's required to draw the cards. And so there's at least 2 mana required. And so I generally didn't include things like Izzet Charm and all the other things that draw, or Night's Whisper, that draw cards for investment of more than 1 mana for the reason. I didn't put Expressive Iteration for that reason. I think they're slightly different than a cantrip because of the increased mana investment, but I could be wrong about that. I could have put Remand in there as well, you know?
Yeah, I know. There's so many things that draw a card. There's lots of creatures that draw a card as well, which is why it's important to get clear on our definition. Yeah, so on my definition, Acorn's not a cantrip. Acorn's just a different, it's a draw spell. But on your definition, it's something cheap that draws a card and offers an additional effect of some kind. Yeah. All right. So, Brainstorm. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so Brainstorm, obviously, if you're splashing blue, it's probably like, you know, if in a four color deck, it's definitely one of the, like, the blue spell that you play. Like, it's almost, you know, not a choice to play it, because it's so powerful in a format that's full of fetch lands. Obviously, it can completely change the complexion of your hand, being able to draw three cards and put back two, and then shuffle away the cards that aren't of as much use in a game. So sometimes you'll see blue mid-range decks playing only one cantrip, and it would be Brainstorm for that reason. And it's obviously dominant across a range of Eternal format. So across it's the defining card of Legacy, and it's restricted in Vintage. So it would be unusual to see a blue deck not play that one.
It's interesting to say, yeah, like, not only it doesn't change the complexion of your hand, it literally changes your hand. Like,
yeah.
Which is, for me, like, it's definitely a cantrip. It offers selection on my definition, and doesn't gain card advantage. But yeah, by changing your hand, it does something that other cantrips don't do. Most cantrips just change your draw step or change the next card you draw. This one changes your hand, and that's big. And that's why I can give you virtual card advantage by putting away dead cards or whatever. Cards that are dead in that moment. All right, yeah, so it's very powerful, obviously. All right, Careful Study, tell me about that one.
Okay, so let's put Careful Study and Faithless Looting in the same category so we can deal with them reasonably quickly. Like, this is I balked us for a moment at, like, including Faithless Looting and Careful Study, because they don't really replace themselves. Like, there's a card disadvantage in those. You're drawing two cards and discarding two cards. But they do change the complexion of your hand. And that's particularly useful in certain kinds of graveyard-oriented combo decks. And so you'll see in Highlander, those two cards largely played in Reanimator and Dredge-based strategies, where you really want to be using your graveyard. Faithless Looting was banned in Modern because it was thought to be too powerful in that context. Just the selection, if you have ways to use the graveyard, is extremely powerful for one.
Yeah, and again, that changes your hand, doesn't it? It doesn't just change your draw step. That's interesting. Right. It's interesting to play that.
You know, there's, like, that investment of mana to, like, there's usually a lot of gains to be had in Magic in investing small resources to change zones between, like, library to hand to graveyard and to battlefield. And so, those are probably the two best spells you'll see in Australian Highlander that have that effect, at least in terms of a spell, rather than sort of Bazaar of Baghdad or something like
that. Yeah, well, I mean, you might be thinking of Mendendian and Kevin Cron. They were talking about how the power, one way to index or measure the power of a card is how many zone changes it affects. Mm-hmm. Like, is it moving cards from graveyard or library or hand or whatever? And, like, Bazaar of Baghdad does that big time. You know, you draw two cards and discard three, and Doomsday does it probably the most, because you just get rid of most of your library or whatever.
Is Doomsday a cantrip?
No,
it's not.
They're just saying it's a powerful card because it does so many zone changes. It's interesting. So these cards are card disadvantageous. You're going down a card, but you're getting big selection, you're changing your hand, and you're loading up on a resource in your graveyard, which you need to recoup not only the tempo here but also the card disadvantage. So you need to use that graveyard somehow to maintain parity or get an advantage. And so obviously you'd see these cards in Reanimator and other strategies.
They're so good in that context. Like, they're so good in the graveyard context that, you know, you'll see, like, Reanimator based strategies that don't play Ponder or Preordain, which we'll get onto, in favor of, like, you know, they can build their decks around redundancy of similar effects. But what really matters is the movement between library to, like, they get that transition from library to graveyard, and the transition from library to hand to graveyard is particularly important because you get to see what is exactly going into your graveyard with those in a way that, say, you know, Thought Scour, Mental Note, Don't Wave.
Yes, and it's not, you get to choose, don't you? It's not random.
Yeah, that's right. The choice, like, you know, is important to those two cards and to decks that want to leverage them.
You said redundancy there, which is another point we haven't touched on. Like, so one of the keys people would, probably the first thing people would say who know a bit about cantrips, was that it increases the consistency of your deck. Like, the fact those options, it allows you to see your lands and or your business when you want to, and that increases consistency at all stages of the game. to the point where, yeah, like a notable innovation in cantrip use, in my view, was in the Mox tournament of last year. European came along, hadn't played the format before, but loaded up on the cantrips. Like started, they played in their rug tempo list, Serum Vision, sleight of hand, things, cantrips, which we'll get to in a second, but traditionally weren't played in that archetype because they weren't thought to be good enough. But there was a huge emphasis on consistency, and he did really well with it. So that's another question, you know, is maybe we could frame this entire discussion is, you know, is 7-point Highlander a sleight of hand format? You know, like where does the power level of the cantrip get low enough that you're better off playing a different card? And I actually don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if sleight of hand should be in most blue decks or not. And it isn't, as a matter of fact, in most blue decks, but maybe we're all wrong.
Yeah, I mean, there could be an element of groupthink going on. I think there's like definitely a core set of cantrips that are commonly played, like the ones that you'll see in Vintage and Legacy. But people do start to balk at some of those, like particularly Serum Visions, which we can get on to.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll jump to that in a sec. But yeah, the last thing I'd say about careful study is like, it would be interesting. We've talked about just graveyard-based strategies as wanting these cards, but it would be interesting if there are so many graveyard synergies and delve, you know, and other types of graveyard synergies in future that maybe just the fair normal deck will play careful study.
Yeah.
I know some, I've seen Mardu deck, like aggro control decks play Faithless Looting just for the hand fixing, and they don't mind the card disadvantage because they've got enough graveyard synergies.
Yeah, if you've got a way to recoup the lost value, then that's definitely possible.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, we talked about, all right, sleight of hand, Serum Vision. So this is a bit of scry. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can see like in the recent events from Nationals, from CanCon, the rug decks started to get on sleight of hand, I think, which we hadn't seen for a long time. Like it was seen to be like too underpowered compared to preordained, like the big ones like Ponder, Preordained, Brainstorm, Taxing Probe. And yet, yeah, I think Justin Chung took sleight of hand to great success. We see that the European player did the same thing. And so that it offers you, you know, a choice, but you only have a choice of one or two. You don't really get to you don't get to keep both cards. So there is like if you have two good spells coming, you can potentially weaken your second draw. So there is like a slight risk there. But yeah, it's interesting to see that it's started to see play, whereas Serum Visions is just, it's completely absent from contemporary deck lists. I can't remember seeing one lately.
Yeah, I mean, if it's like Preordained, but you get the scry after you draw the card, so you can't select that draw step. You're just selecting future draw steps. I think Serum Visions is playable in like a, it's really good on turn one because, you know, it's the future draw steps you care about. But after that, yeah, it gets weaker.
Well, yeah, I think it's like often played in like Storm in like modern formats and things like that, where the higher powered ones aren't playable, where what really matters is setting up future turns.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't know. Like I can't recall seeing Serum Visions in like JP Storm or anything like that. Unless you remember, you played more Storm than I have.
No, I don't think it played Serum Visions. It played Impulse, interestingly. But which isn't on here, but it is a playable 2-mana cantrip, actually, Impulse. Although Fringe playable. But yeah, like Portent does the same thing. It sort of sets up your future draw steps. I mean, it's a slow trip in the sense that you don't draw the card this turn, you draw it in the next upkeep. That can be like a minor disadvantage in a reactive deck, counter spells and things like that. Yeah, but Portent doesn't see a lot of play either. I know Michael Billinghurst and some other players have recently been higher on Portent than in the past because they don't suffer the downside too much in their perspective.
Yeah.
And they just see it as like a kind of slightly worse Ponder.
Yeah, I think it's also, like if it's saw play in Underworld Breach lists a lot, like recently, where again, like you really want to be digging as deep as possible to find your combo pieces quickly. So yeah, it's seen some play there. I think also, like there is something, if you're going to go for the combo, you can kind of portent your opponent. Mm. So there's something in that just to make sure that, you know, they're less likely to have the answer to your combo. the turn before you're about to go for it or what have you.
Yeah. I think it's important to keep in mind too, like Portent has seen like winning legacy play in like miracle lists and stuff like that. It's been a key card in like a powerful deck in a powerful format. So it's obviously a good card in the right spot. So don't be dissuaded from trying out Portent in your deck just because other people aren't playing it. Maybe it's fantastic. I don't know. I mean, I've tried it a little bit and I haven't loved it, but sometimes it just works like Pondo where, yeah, you get the card you want, you shuffle them away with a fetch. The ones you don't want, it can be fantastic. All right, so you've got Probe here. Again, that doesn't meet my definition, doesn't give you selection, but it meets your definition. Yep. Talk to me about Probe.
Yeah, like that's what I was thinking when you were talking initially. Like this card doesn't really give you an extra choice. It just condenses your deck a bit and gives you perfect information about what your opponent's doing. And so like it's commonly played in a range of decks. It also can enable Delve. So if you're playing Moto Region or Gurmag or what have you, then it's good.
Any spell enables Delve.
Yeah. But it's for free.
Any instant and sorcery does. Yeah.
Yeah. It's for free. Yeah.
You didn't have Street Wraith.
Yeah.
I know, why didn't you put Street Wraith here?
Yeah, that's a good point. I probably should have. I just forgot.
Okay.
We should add Street Wraith to the list. But so Gitaxian Probe, yeah. It enables Delve, it draws a card, and it gives you perfect information. But it's one of those ones that, yeah, I think it's really interesting. Like it's played and playable, I think, yeah, if you don't really think about whether you want it. Like I ask myself, like, why doesn't every deck play Gitaxian Probe? Like, why doesn't Junk play Gitaxian Probe? Mm-hmm. Like, to what extent does having information change the way you're going to play the game? So if you're planning on tapping out anyway, do you really gain something from having air in your deck, or do you just prefer to, you've only got 60 cards, do you prefer more business or a mana dork, like greater redundancy and another kind of effect rather than the information? So I find it interesting. I often don't play it, yeah.
But it's not, you said rather than the information, but you can have, Probe gives you the information and the next card. You're still having the business.
Yeah.
So you can play Thomas, I think you're right. I think that you definitely, it's a serious and real question. Should, for example, junk mid-range play Gitaxian Probe? Because Thomas Bott played Gitaxian Probe in his artifact aggro list, even when he was playing Trinisphere and Chalice of the Void.
Yeah.
So he obviously really valued the information in terms of sequencing his plays, knowing which threat to play first or how to play against what his opponents was planning to do. I mean, I haven't reached that point yet, but because I think the life loss is a real cost, especially if you can't pay blue, isn't it? But you're not getting the options that selection provides, but you're getting options. That information is giving you the option of, well, maybe I should play this instead of that now.
Yeah, that's right.
So it is a powerful card, but just can you afford the life? If you're an aggro deck or have a lot of life gain, maybe, yeah, it is quite free and that the cost can be negated or ignored.
Yeah, I don't think... I often find myself thinking, like, what, you know, if I want to spend my mana or whatever, or, like, if I want an effect, to what extent is this effect, like, as relevant as another effect in my 60?
But you're only... Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah. Like, by playing this, you're not playing another card in your deck, right?
Yeah.
But that can be an advantage as well. You're playing a 59 card deck.
Yeah, I know. This is why I don't have the answer to the question.
Yeah,
whether or not I should.
59 card deck should be, if 60 card deck's better than 61 card deck, which conventional wisdom says it is, and careful analysis also says it is, then maybe you should. If Probe was like didn't cost life, if it was just zero mana, I think everyone would play it. I think it's just the life loss that means it's a real question. And I think that's the same with Horizon Canopy. Back in the day, like there was serious question, like Isaac Egan never played Horizon Canopy, even in the decks that would have otherwise wanted it, because he didn't think the life loss was worth it.
Yeah. It's
just the life loss. Yeah, like and Probe's a card I play and enjoy in like a control deck because it gives me info. It fuels my JVP. But I definitely side it out against aggro.
Hmm.
I can't afford the life loss there.
Yeah, I've heard, like, I recall because I'd want to like push my mana like in the past as far as possible. I would feel compelled if I was playing some kind of control deck to play a basic land in the sideboard if I was playing Gitaxian Probe in the main, just because like I was at the edge of my mana capacities. And if I had to cut the probe, I was going to like potentially like, you know, expand the size of my deck slightly. And that meant that I was less likely to hit the lands that I needed, but that's probably because I got tended to play four color greed piles. So,
no, I think that makes sense because it goes back to our point that the origin of like loading up on cantrips, it meant cutting down on lands. So if suddenly your cantrips are turned off by like a Charles for one or whatever, then you are going to struggle to find the mana you need. Yeah. So equally, if you're your probe's cut off through not being able to afford the life, then yeah, you're gonna go down a mana. So having that extra mana source in the sideboard makes sense. Yeah. Well, I've talked
I mean, lately, like when I was thinking about Gitaxian Probe, I end up playing Abundant Harvest over it because I'm playing four colors, right? And for me, like the way I lose is if I can't hit my colors. And so drawing an extra random card from my deck was less important than finding my next blue or green land or what have you in the early game. Yeah.
And that goes back to selection being different from just drawing a random card.
Yeah.
So Street Wraith is like Probe, but you don't get the information, so that's a big difference. So what do you get? You get something in the bin for Delve or Reanimate, and you get the option of playing a 5-mana, 3-4 Swamp Walk late in the game.
Yeah, or reanimating this thing.
Yeah. But you don't see a lot of Street Wraith in just fair decks just because the life loss is relevant.
Yeah, I also think like Lurrus has also affected Street Wraith. So the kind of decks that might want to play Street Wraith also love having Lurrus. And so you kind of go, if you're on that kind of combo deck, there's kind of a disincentive naturally built in as a result of the companion.
Yeah. All right. So let's mental note and thoughts, Gal. They've seen a lot of play recently, especially with
Lurrus
and Euro.
Yeah, I've liked these ones for a long time. Like they don't give you any. They don't give you as much selection. Like you don't know what's going to get dumped into your bin. But if you play a high density of Delve spells, they read Dark Ritual, draw a card. So if you know they give you the shot, unlike the other cantrips of playing Tassica or Murktide Regent on the second turn. They also are more likely to make a Tarmogoyf. If you play Tarmogoyf, on the second turn as well. They're really powerful also that they're instants. So compared to the other cantrips, which we've talked about, which a lot of them are sorceries, you can kind of hold up your spell pierce if you're in a tempo-oriented strategy. And then you've still got, if you don't use a spell pierce on that turn, you've got something to spend the mana on because usually you want to maximize mana expenditure on each turn. That's generally a good principle or heuristic to live by in a fast format, I think.
Yeah. Spending that mana and you're fueling the graveyard as a resource. And yeah, it's interesting that you said you're not getting as much selection. I would have said you're getting no selection, but yeah, you are getting some selection because if you know the top card of your library or the opponent's library somehow, maybe through a reality chip or whatever, portent or whatever, then you can time it to give you selection. Which is interesting. This is probably a corner case, but it's there.
Yeah, Fortica is a cool one as well because it has the portent effect. You know, you can mess with your opponent's top two cards. Say if your opponent, Mystical Tutors for something, you can play, Fortica to interact with that.
Mm.
Or, we've had a depointing of Personal Tutor. And so you may see people playing more top deck strategies. So consider Fortica as potentially a defensive spell as well. Against Doomsday, that kind of thing.
I remember like a year or probably 2 years ago, like myself and others I know were, I'm not sure if you were included among them, but we were quite low on these cards, like Mental Note and Thought Scout. We thought if you have to play these cards to empower, to get your deck doing its thing, then you're not on the right page somehow.
There's something wrong. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's been played for years. Like in newbie in like Brandon Owen's like blue black Delvo, it was obviously a really important card for the reasons that you said. It empowered that delve, and time has proven that approach is very effective, and these cards are very popular now. But there was a time when the fact that it didn't give you any selection, I found it was just spinning your wheels. It wasn't giving you enough. The graveyard, adding wasn't enough. But I think these days it is enough, more than enough.
Yeah, Murktide and Euro make them good. I really like. I had a revelation recently in realizing that the extent to which Euro is a friend of cantrips rather than of mana dorks. So you want to be able to cast that thing at least twice. And so Mental Note and Thought Scarab become central to rug based strategies just because they can refuel that card and it's so powerful that it's worth it.
Yeah. So I can see that if you're thinking in those terms, then the selection isn't the primary value of the cantrip. It's just filling the bin.
Yeah. They're effectively mana. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of how I think about it.
But they need, but it's costing mana to get that mana.
Yeah.
So, so you're right. Like if Thoughtscour said, put the top card rather than the top two cards, maybe it wouldn't be good enough.
That's what Consider does, right? But gives you a choice.
But Consider gives you a choice. Thoughtscour doesn't. If Thoughtscour just said, put the top card in, then draw.
No, not good enough.
Okay.
It's the depth because it itself is in the bin and then the other two cards as well. So it's put three mana in the bin, basically, for a delve spell.
Okay.
So it's a Dark Ritual draw card.
Well, yeah, before we get to Consider, we'll go to Opt because Opt was like first. Now, Opt's been around a long time. And I meant to say as well, even when Brainstorm was printed, it took quite a while for vintage players to realize, I'm told, the power of Brainstorm. They didn't just jump on it. I think they ignored it for a long time. And Opt as well. Opt has been playable for like decades, I think. And
I don't see a huge amount of it though these days. It's still around, but it's not in the same.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's popular in like standard, like lower powered forms where it's playable. But yeah, I mean, it had the unique selling point of being an instant. So you could get this selection, this small selection at instant speed. But yeah, I don't think vintage, they didn't see that much playing vintage. Probably saw a little bit. But yeah, I played it in Highlander probably 2 years ago when Loot Tree came out. I wanted some more targets to copy with Loot Tree, and I found Opt was adequate, more than adequate in like a reactive deck where I value the instant speed. And I'm not on it at the moment though, because it is sometimes pretty low impact. Have you ever played Opt?
Nah. Okay. I don't know. Right. Just never seem to cut it in my.
No, you're more the sleight of hand kind of guy. Yeah. Whereas Consider's been come out very recently, and people have jumped on that quickly. Why is Consider so much better than Opt?
Oh, I think it's sort of a halfway house between Thoughtscour and Opt. If you know what I mean, it gives you more information than Thoughtscour, but also fuels your graveyard not quite as much. But it does some of that. Yeah. So it's like Thoughtscour with more options. I don't know. I kind of wax and wane on this one. Usually like it'll get to a point where this would be the last one that you're working out what to cut and what to include. And so the ones I toss up are usually Probe and Consider at the moment. Because I ask myself, for Probe, to what extent do I really value having the information and Consider? What I prefer is to go deeper with Thoughtscour and Mental Note if I want a lot of actual business in my list. But look, yeah, it's super popular in Breach, super popular in Rug Tempo. So it's definitely cuts it.
You think it cuts it in like even outside of like dedicated delve strategies? Like if you don't have that much graveyard synergy, just the odd card, do you think Consider's good enough then?
Don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I haven't tried it. It's an interesting discussion point or an interesting point for the format to discover. I think people who play Consider should share their views on it, yeah. I know Rob Lark played it in his winning list, So it's obviously got good pedigree there.
Yeah, Lachlan Saunders was playing it in Breach as well.
Okay.
Yeah, Nationals. Yeah.
But yeah, I suppose what question we're often coming to is like this kind of pantheon of like Brainstorm, Ponder, Preordain, these unpointed, powerful cantrips. How close are these cards getting to there? You know what I mean? Like, is consider or sleight of hand or portent? Should they be considered, you know, not far behind them or quite a bit far behind them? And I'm not sure. Yeah, my suspicion is quite a fair bit far behind them, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think you see them. Well, like the combo decks really value just churning through, right, and trying to find important pieces. So consider is good in Breach from that perspective. I think it's also played like in the Rogue Tempo list because they're trying to, up until recently, they're trying to run both Euro and Murktide, and you do need like quite a lot of graveyard fill, and there's only one of Mental Note and one of Thought Scar, right? And so you do end up valuing having more spells just going to the graveyard as well.
Yeah, you're right. You're right to answer that question very contextually in terms of which archetype, which deck, what it's trying to do. There's no real point evaluating them in abstract. But all right, so they're the blue ones. So you talked about Bun and Harvest. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so yeah, green one. So it's in Japanese there, but it allows you to like name land or non-land. And then you keep revealing the cards from the top until you find the type that you're after. And so this is a great, for my mind, like I found it good, particularly in four color decks where finding colors of mana in the early game is really critical to make sure that you can continue to cast spells. It helps, you know, if you get one of your colors wastelanded or something like that, it really matters. I also play it with Omnas, Locus of Creation, because in the late game, if you've got that in play, finding a land in the late game can actually be really helpful. And also, yeah, you know, if you really are starting to flood out, you can make sure you find business as well if you've got enough lands. And so, yeah, I found it to be pretty good, actually. And it, look, it's a green spell, so if you need to have enough green spells to pitch to like Endurance, if you're trying to stop Breach or Thassa's Oracle, you've got that one extra green spell that you mightn't otherwise have access to if you want to get up to, you know, if I play Pitch, I always like to have at least 14 of that color cards in the deck so that I know I'm likely to have two of that color card in my hand when it matters. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I was pretty quickly sold on this card because it fulfills that fundamental role of finding mana early and business late, which is what I look for in a cantrip. Or if I've got a mana. So Mana Screw and Mana Flood are some of the fundamental challenges for Magic deck design, dealing with these. It's just a fundamental part of the game. Other card games won't have it. So having the right mix of lands and spells is just baked into the game of Magic. And so cantrips are a way of like solving that problem. And this card does that very directly. Which one do you want now? You know? So for me, that's really awesome. And I quickly put that just behind, say, Preordain, like the fourth best cantrip when I first saw it. I mean, but again, those abstract lists are fairly meaningless, but I think it's very powerful. Yeah. But is it powerful enough? So should Junk play that card?
I don't know. So, well, does it value, because, you know, if you're playing to a curve, right, so you invest a resource, which is a mana, and if that deck is really about accelerating into three drops on the second turn, then you're investing mana in no board presence.
Yeah.
So you're probably messing up your curve a little bit in order to, you know, to have that effect. But look, you know, non-blue decks, like, do have like one kind of flaw in the mid game and in not having those as much choice, so as much selection. And that's when the dust settles and everybody's playing, that, you know, like living off the top deck. And the blue player draws like Ponder or Preordain, like that can be the end of the game. Because they just have, you know, like basically three turns worth of better choices than the non-blue player. And so it will give like a green deck a better shot at actually hitting business. And those decks are like loaded with like strong business spells. You know, that's how they're built.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know. I think it's a tough one.
Yeah. I don't think Becca would play it because I think Becca would say, "Oh, it's not on plan. I want to commit to the board, you know, and I'll curve out and commit to the board at all and win the board at all stages. So it's not on plan." But the question is it powerful enough to be played even though it's not on plan for the reasons that you said?
Yeah, we were talking earlier about like Mardu decks playing Faithless Looting. There's a similar argument to be made here that you could play Abundant Harvest.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that this doesn't do is that Preordain, you can pick between two business spells or two lands. Like this
doesn't give you no doubt better. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just trying to articulate. I'm trying to think through the qualities of the card. Yeah. I think it's good. I think it's worth the mana.
I think it's look, I've tested a whole bunch of different cantrips in my four color decks, and this is one of my favorites. For that reason, like how important is like hitting that early land to you? Well, like hitting lands in the first four turns. You know, how important is that to you? And if it's important, like I think it's particularly good in Simic kind of deck. You know,
well the real answer to that is if it's important. So I think every deck wants to ask itself, when can I afford to miss a land drop? Because that's what'll help you answer how many lands I should have in my deck. So if you want to hit all four, the first four lands, I mean, honestly, you probably should be playing 24 lands. But people who are used to having cantrips say, no, that's way too many. They get greedy.
Yeah.
And smartly so, they say, no, instead of those last two or three lands, I'll just play all these cantrips instead. We'll have to get to that question, how many cantrips should one play as well, when we get to the end of this list. All right, so Cling to Dust. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it says draw a card. Like, I think it's one of the interesting ones that has like an interactive effect. There's not many of those. We get down to the artifacts in a bit, but you know, the blue ones don't necessarily. We talked about Porton and Thoughtscale being able to play with the top of the opponent's library, but Cling to Dust removes a card from the graveyard and draws a card, and that's like super powerful. There's some of the cards that get played out of the graveyard these days. You know, the difference between winning and losing. I think Michael Billinghurst is like, people are talking about it as a sideboard card when it first came out. And it's like, oh no, this is like straight up main deck, a main deck card. So yeah, like if you take your opponent's lines like Diamond out of the graveyard in advance of them breaching, like that combo's over. So it's super powerful. I like that it's an instant. It preserves, you know, timing options. It can help you just dig that one card deeper if you're struggling on mana at the same time as interacting with your opponent. So they can gain life. It's also like a good, if you need an entomb target and, you know, there isn't an obvious one and you want to use your mana, like you can entomb Cling to Dust and, you know, then like have it there to escape if you need to draw cards in the late game. And
yeah,
I played in a tournament and I was playing against Michael Leslie and I was on Thassa's Oracle. I think I must have drawn about four cards off a Cling to Dust in the graveyard and just kept me in the game. So I think it's a super powerful.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very unique. You did well to identify those different qualities, like the fact that it interacts with your opponent's resources in a card neutral way, like in the way that it replaces itself and also offers a draw engine in the late game. It's super powerful. It's really powerful, this card. I think most black decks should play it.
I mean, it doesn't ice the entire graveyard. So if the predominant combo deck in the format is Underworld Breach, and like we don't know where the metagame is going to go yet, but it's not quite as good there because if the breach players can hold up two blue, they can play around any attempt to remove the brain freeze. But it's still awesome. Yeah,
well, it's different from Neil Spellbomb. Neil Spellbomb does what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And is another awesome card. Although it hasn't seen much main deck play, to be honest, for what it warrants, in my opinion. I'd pretty much play it in most of the time where I can.
Yeah, at the time of like sort of Grixis Oracle Breach, which is now like you can't play anymore. There was quite a few players who put it in the main deck, but some people shaved on it and just put it in the sideboard. But I really liked it with Lewis, just like being able to repeatedly like nerf people's graveyards and draw a card every turn. Yeah, it's a draw engine and an interactive spell.
Yeah, so that could,
with Lewis the Dream Den. Yeah.
Just before we move on to like the artifacts, like I'm sure there's other cards that interact. Like they probably, but they probably cost two mana. Like give your creature +1/+1, draw a card, or make your creature indestructible, draw a card, or
there's all the other spell bombs. Like I probably should put them in the list. You know, there's like Aether Spell Bomb and Pyrite Spell Bomb and stuff like that.
Yes, but you can't have your cake and eat it too. There, you've got you have the effect, like you do the two damage, or you draw the card. You never do both. That's the problem. Yeah. So they effectively just have cycled stapled onto them. Cycling stapled onto them. So, but yeah, interestingly, I would play this. Like if there was a card that was like one red, do a damage, one damage to any target, draw a card, I would play that. But there isn't that card, surprisingly. Yeah, I don't know. So that would be a card that interacts a little bit and draws a card. Yeah, so you've got Metamorphose, which is like, which is mana fixing. And a lot of the artifacts here are color fixing specifically. So that's the effect they provide in addition to the drawing of the card. There's no selection in the artifacts except for Mishra's Bauble, and we'll get to that. But yeah, I always tell you to play Metamorphose as like a second Gitaxian Pro, but you never do.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I just feel like it's a storm card, you know? You still have to invest the two, you have to tap the two lands. I don't know. And you know, and then if you're just drawing a random card and you're not using that, then it's not as good. But there are certain decks where like that's really critical. So for Storm, like switching between red and black mana and things like that was like really critical. There are also decks that put a really high price on zero mana spells. So this has like been a fixture in prowess decks and things like that, which are looking for like a critical mass of spells on a single turn.
So but arguably like any Storm Delve
archetype is like good for that. Yeah.
No, you're right. But arguably a Delve deck wants Metamorphose for the same reasons it wants Probe.
Yeah. I think you just get to how many, you know? It's kind of that do I want that effect or do I want Metamorphose? And I end up like, picking something else. I don't know why. Are you playing because you were playing in your control deck for a long time,
right? Well, I think I played it because I had a Blood Moon strategy and it's good against and with Blood Moon. It's also good if you have any cost reductions, like Storm has Helm of Awakening or whatever, which allows this to generate mana. Like Patrick Traven was big on it. It's just basically being free. It was turning up in a lot of like burn decks just as a way to like play like a smaller deck and fuel the graveyard for like Grim Lavamancer. Even when they were playing Eidolon, they didn't care. They wanted Metamorphose even more. So I think it's super powerful. The problem is if you run in, you can randomly run into a spell snare when you're not banking on it.
Yeah.
That sucks. And if you ever want to like use one mana but save one mana for the next turn, like to hold up Spell Pierce or something, it's really bad there as well. And it can be bad as a top deck where you just have to name random colors. Sometimes you get punished by drawing your double white card or whatever. So it has downsides, but it also has big advantages. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really cool. So a lot of these cards, like the eggs and the Chromatic Sphere, Chromatic Star, they fix colors. So you lose a mana. Yeah, but that's normal. All cantrips, most of these cantrips cost a mana. The ones that don't, and there's a bit more graveyard disruption in Phyrexian Furnace and Scrabbling Claws.
Yeah. Well, I want you to talk about Scrabbling Claws and Phyrexian Furnace and Amisha's Bauble and Urza's Bauble because you always play these four in your control decks and they... But like the two claws, or the furnace and the claws always wreck me because I like to abuse my graveyard. But also you were playing Bauble and the two Baubles in control before, without Lurus, you know, and without Dragon's Rage Channeler. So a lot of people have got on the Baubles because they want to get Delirium for Dragon's Rage Channeler lately. But like you had used these cards as kind of like piggy banks for cards with it in a balanced strategy. Can you like take us through that?
Yeah, all right. My deck was like a balance based or mirror blue white red control, which I called Bourbon and Co. But yeah, so I was looking for ways to deploy my cards to the board balance and then like get the cards back. So yeah, I described them. You just used the term piggy banks. So you put your card, your Mistress Bauble, down on the board, you cast balance, and then you cash it in to draw back. And then you're up cards relative to your opponent. I also wanted ways to like trigger mentor as well. So cantrips, and you talked about prowess as well, how these are really good ways of just getting mentor and other prowess triggers. So I experimented with like loading up on these kind of baubles and little artifact effects to abuse balance and mentor. And yeah, like I got all the way to Pyrite Spellbomb. I found that was just playable because the removal sometimes was helpful because it was a reactive deck. It didn't want to, but yeah, it was, I wouldn't play Pyrite Spellbomb now. I don't think it cuts it now. But yeah,
Lurrus. I think it's so good with Lurrus, but that's
fine. Yeah. I'm not talking about recursion synergies. I'm just talking about a fair application. But then what I discovered about Mistress Bauble, and this is probably what others have discovered, why it's independently or before me, while it's so why it's so popular in Legacy, is that if you just have a fetch land, it gives you free selection. Like it allows you to look at the top card, and then you can choose to shuffle your fetch land now or next turn to shape the next draw step you have off the Bauble. And that for me was like mind blowing. Like the fact that you could get like a Scry one for zero mana. Even though you draw the card slightly slower, like it's not as fast as Opt, but you get the card later, but you get the free Scry. That for me was just like broken. I'm going to play it in everything. Deck with fetch lands. Yeah.
Yeah. And no, that's good. Like, so like, you know, I've been mucking around with Underworld Breach and I want to play Nihil Spellbomb if I'm going to play Lurrus, right? But, you know, often people play just as Bauble and Mistress Bauble together, but Mistress Bauble is like, I think, like light years more powerful than Urza's Bauble.
Instead of selection with Urza's Bauble, you just get a little bit of information in looking at a card in their hand. Yeah. Sometimes that's super helpful, especially if they've only got one card in hand. But most of the time, it's kind of random and irrelevant. Well, not irrelevant, but it's of minimal value. Certainly compared to Scry 1, it's nowhere near that. So yeah, Mistress Bauble, I think, is way better. And then the claws. Well, yeah, I mean the claws and the furnace. Like, well, I started my deck building in earnest in Highlander, like when Craddy Jund had like just won the national championships, which is like this mid-range Lansy strategy. And I just was playing a control deck that was, I just didn't want to lose to Life from the Loam. I needed main deck interaction to not lose to Life from the Loam. So these were kind of ways that I could play in a Jeskai deck. I could not lose.
They were playable in Vintage at some point in time as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, the reason I picked Claws was it was like a sideboard card in my control deck. Oh, well, in an Esper control deck that was designed by Steve O'Connell or Zerbus. And he used it as a sideboard card against Goblin Welder, against Control Slaver kind of strategy. Yeah. He had an Esper deck and he just needed ways to negate the advantage of Goblin Welder. And because it was a control mirror, he needed to do that in a way where he wouldn't go down on cards. And so I liked Furnace and Claws as a second Furnace as a way to disrupt Graveyard without going down on cards, which is what Cling to Dust does as well, in an even better way.
I probably should have put Relic of Progenitus in there.
Well, the problem with Relic of Progenitus is that it stuffs up your own Graveyard.
Yeah.
And so that's a big cost. Especially in the era where we're talking about empowering Delve and getting graveyard synergies and all that. It's a huge cost. Furnace and Claws don't have that. And Scrab and Claws has some other cute interactions where you can target your own graveyard and choose the card that with the tap ability. And that's relevant against Klothos. You can fizzle that ability and against Deathrite Shaman if they're trying to do that. So I actually do prefer Claws just for those fringe reasons.
No, it's definitely relevant against Clothos, like being able to neutralize that. Like, you know, if your opponent's, investing 3 mana in Clothos and it's not doing anything, it's just a massive tempo advantage.
Yeah, but we kind of got off topic, like, because I don't consider these cantrips, but they don't give me selection, but they give me interaction in a way that allows me not to go down on cards. That means that makes them main deckable. And it means I can sometimes just win. I think I've won a game like just with Scrub and Claws turn one because my opponent had like Snapcaster, Dig Through Time, Tassigar, you know, all those cards. And I just kept tapping it. And I didn't know what was happening, but they just conceded like after a few turns. And yeah, so these cards can be powerful in the Delve era. However, like I'm down to just playing one main deck, because if you draw two against a very aggressive deck, that tempo loss, even when you're trying to cycle them away, is very real, and you just get beaten on the board.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's where the tempo cost of cantrips can really bite you against aggressive decks. All right. So do you want to say anything more before we jump onto some alternatives to these?
No, I don't think Ponder or Preordain require too much analysis. Apart from like, there's often difficult questions around whether to fetch around those cantrips, I think.
Yeah, Ponder. Fetch before or after Preordain.
Yeah, and Ponder, like, you know, do you want to, I think it depends on what point in the game you're at. You know, like, are you going to want all three of those cards or not? Or can you afford to give yourself the option to shuffle? And that depends on how many lands you're kind of going to play.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a whole lot of discussion to be had in, like, how to play these cards and when to play them. Like, I know that, yeah, I mean, you could write a whole probably thesis on brainstorming when to play it. You know, you could definitely write a book on it. Like I know Becca would just say quickly, when you cast Preordain, just you have to, and like thought sees, you have to know what you're looking for. Like, you have to have a reason to play it. Don't just throw it out there because you get the card back.
Yeah.
If you don't know what you're looking for, maybe you should hold off on it. Maybe you can't because the tempo loss later you can't afford, but maybe you can hold off on it. The cards do tend to become more powerful as the game goes on. But you're clear on what you need and so on.
Yeah, unless you're going to miss a land, like, yeah, try and hold it. I think it's probably stay early in the game. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't like turn one Ponder, for example, but I do like turn one Preordain.
Yeah. It's funny because it's different to like the other Eternal formats where if you've got four, you can like four Brainstorms and four Ponders, you just chuck them out there. Like, you know, it's like, there's like a heuristic. It's just like Island, Ponder, Keep, right? in Legacy, so we just can't do that in this format. It's just different.
Yeah. I mean, my rule of thumb with fetch lands and Ponder and Preordain is like, I'll ponder. I'll always ponder first and then fetch. So I'm happy just to keep the one card, the best card out of the three.
Yeah.
And with Preordain, I'll fetch first and then Preordain because I might want to keep both cards.
Yeah. I usually fetch before preordaining, but I think Ponder's a difficult one.
Yeah.
Usually
it just
depends on when I'm casting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's always situational. All right. So what happens if you don't want to play blue? Right? You don't have many options. You've got some artifacts that just cantrip, for want of a better word. They just cycle through. They don't give you selection. And you've got a few corner cases in Faithless Looting, Plink to Dust, and Abundant Harvest is notably an exception. But yeah, if you're not playing blue, what are you doing? You're not getting that selection. So how do you get options in a different way? So this is something I've been forced to think through lately because I'm trying like an artifact deck, for instance. And one of the challenges, there's multiple challenges to playing and building an artifact deck. But one of them is, you can solve the problem of mana screw by playing lots of lands. Fine. You're going to find your lands. But then you run into the problem of mana flood in the late game. So how do you solve that? How do you just gain the advantage of cantrips without having access to blue? So you want other spells that give you like mana early and business late. Okay. So I'll just talk about Llanowar Elf, right?
Yeah.
So this has been around since Alpha. There's a few Alpha cards here. Now these aren't cantrips. These don't replace them. They don't all replace themselves and offer selection, but they do. They may fulfill similar functions in terms of providing mana early and business late. Okay, so Llanowar Elf, it gives you mana early. Okay, it's a mana door. Now
I agree with that.
Okay, yeah. Now can you afford to top deck it on turn six or whatever?
Feels bad unless you got Skull Clamp or something like that. Exactly. I've played decks with 8+ mana dorks, and you got to, if you're going to play, if you're going to go down as deep as Atlanta or else, you're going to need something to do with it beyond just relying on it as a 1/1 on turn 6.
But, yeah, but this is the thing, like, so we raised the question, we didn't answer it, like, how many cantrips should you play? And not, like, at what point is Llanowar Elf better or a Mana Dork better than the worst cantrip in your deck? And that's really hard to answer because they do different things, but they also do similar things. And that's what I'm trying to propose. Give you mana early and business late. The business late comes in the form of, like, okay, well, you can chump block and you can attack with it. It's only a 1/1, but it's something. And yeah, if you've got Skullclamp, Birthing Pod, other ways to, or even Oko to upgrade this thing, other ways to use it in a meaningful way, then it can be relevant in the late game. Yep. But yeah, I know you were confronting the question recently, like, should I play cantrips or mana dorks? And when do I switch from one to the other? Like, how many of each should I play if I want to play both?
Yeah.
How did you answer that question?
Well, usually in part it came down to curve questions. So I was like, okay, so how many 1-mana spells do I want to play? So I generally prefer 10, but I settled on 9 ultimately. On the understanding I might have to fetch up a shock land tapped on my opponent's end step on the odd occasion. The other overarching consideration was the overwhelming power of Uro and Murktide Regent. And so I found that the mana dork strategy meant that I was tending only to get one escape from Uro, whereas playing Thought Scour and Mental Note over a dork made it more likely that I could play those premium threats and play Uro more than once. In addition, like if you play things like Jace Prince Prodigy or Dreadhorde Arcanist, being able to double Thought Scour over like a mana dork has benefits. You know, like you can refuel your graveyard more quickly in a way that you can't if your Llanowar Elf dies. Cantrips aren't as vulnerable to interaction. So if you invest your 1 mana in your Llanowar Elf and then it just gets killed. But people tend not to counterspell cantrips. Like sometimes there are edge cases where they do in the mid to late game, but the cantrips tend to still have value in a way that, you know, in the mid to late game, in a way that a mana dork doesn't, unless you're really dedicated to finding ways to leverage them. So yeah, you could use Birthing Pod or Skull Clamp. You can turn them into Elks with Oko. And you can obviously like experimenting with the Royal Scions to give them Trample and First Strike using the middle ability. But there's just, yeah, I don't know. In the end, the balance I arrived at was the two Hierarchs and then a bunch of cantrips.
Oh, so you like
that's just practical wisdom, right? Just testing over and over again. That seemed to work the best.
Well, that was where the power level kind of line was drawn through experience. Yeah.
And just having the right quantity to be able to use Murktide and Uro and also have a bit of protection from Blood Moon, and also the Exalted on the two Hierarchs is relevant to winning combat. So
yeah,
that was how the calculus played out. It's kind of like you end up, I don't know, just muddling. I just ended up muddling my way through based on testing. Yeah.
You made observations, and you tuned your deck. That's what you got to do. Theory is just a starting point. Yeah. So, what was I going to say? Yeah. So this was an insight I came to recently. It's like, so the blue decks, they cast their cantrips and then they recoup the mana through delve. But the mana dork decks cast their mana early and then they recoup the cards in the late game through Skull Clamp or Birthing Pod. Yeah, so they're kind of doing similar things but in different order and with different tools. In other words, the blue deck converts its options into mana, like its option generating cards into mana, and the junk or the Llanowar Elf deck converts its mana generating cards into options like later. Yeah,
that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. So we'll talk about lands as well. Like, as I said before, like, utility lands have since alpha or since antiquities, you know, provided like mana early and business late. You can have your mana, Mishra's Factory provide mana when you need it on early on, and then later on it can be a a creature. So other lands do this as well. Like, Urza Saga is a very egregious example. But,
shocking.
So that's giving you the best of both. Yeah, but like Lonely Sand. So I asked the question, Lonely Sandbar, right? It's just to come into play tapped, blue land that has cycling for one blue. I asked the question before, like, is Highlander a sleight of hand format? And the answer is maybe not. But who knows? Is it a Lonely Sandbar format?
Like, I think it might have been in 2017.
Why not? Well, it gives you mana early and business late, but the problem is the mana early is bad, like it's slow, and the business late is just random. It's a random card. It's not something specific.
Yeah. I think, like, in practical terms, like, you would never play Lonely Sandbar over, like, Nurturing Peatland or Horizon Canopy or something anymore. Like, because those ones give you the actual mana early and then gives you the business late, because you can, like, chuck them in when you've got enough lands.
And they give you color fixing as well.
Yeah, and if you're going to pair that with, like, Life from the Loam or Venom 6 to create an engine, you'd probably prefer to have a canopy land, I'd say. So I think, like, Sandbar, because it comes into play tapped, is now outclassed.
Really, yeah, you're right. I didn't think of that. So Horizon Lands, they're a perfect example. They're, like, a way to get the functional equivalent of a cantrip. It gives you the mana early and the business late. The problem is, it's better as mana early than a cantrip. You don't have to invest the mana to get that. But it's worse later as business, because you do have to invest. You're investing an extra mana and you're not getting selection. You're just getting a random card.
Yeah, you're investing two mana to draw a card late, really.
Yeah.
Because you lose the canopy itself.
Yeah. And Irrigated Farmland does that too. Like, but again, the mana early is worse. Yeah, than Horizon Canopy, but you don't have to pay life. So the life loss is real. But yeah, obviously the Horizon lands have proven to be powerful in the right dose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Inventor's Fair, Academy Ruins, these are just cards that provide mana early and business late in different ways. Now this and cycling lands, but yeah, we've said Horizon lands are kind of probably the best. But yeah, like Besaidu. So this is a new kind of, I think.
Broken. Busted in half. Awesome.
Well, that, like, I have to tell a bit of a story. Like, when I took a long break from Magic, when I came back when Mirrodin was being drafted, and I started drafting Mirrodin, and there were all these spell effects stapled onto creatures. Like, you had a 3-mana 2/2 who could also be a disenchant, something like that. And coming from, like, my 4-player, multiplayer, casual kind of background, I was like, this is awesome. Like, I can just play all creatures now. I don't have to play just standalone spells. So why wouldn't I just play all creatures, like, if I can? Now, I don't think we're there yet that we can have 60 lands in our deck. But if they printed enough good Besaidu-type cards, which are good mana and good business, you could conceivably do that. Then you wouldn't need cantrips. And you'd fundamentally solve the problem of getting the right mix of lands and business by all your cards being both lands and business all the time.
When they printed this, I was just like, oh, thank God I can play 22 lands in my deck, you know, and not feel like I was at the margins, like I was going to have something useful to do. Like, it was just such a, so good. And then, like, yeah, because I like playing Renin 6, like, you can just, like, destroy artifact-based strategies. Like,
yeah. Well, amazing. Yeah. But my point is about, because we're talking about cantrips, not just how good Besaidu is. It's like, it's both mana and business. Yeah. If you're playing a non-blue deck, for instance, or if you're playing a blue deck and you want even more options, these kind of cards provide that. And there are other lands not quite as good that do that, like Kasandu Mammoth and Valakut Awakening. Now they come into play tap lands, so you're paying a fair cost. You're paying a cost in tempo for getting this option of mana early, business late. But you're paying that mana with Preordain as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which you can't forget. So I know Sarv is quite high on Kasandu Mammoth. He's played it a bit in his decks. So the mana early is bad because it comes into play tap, but the business late is not just a random card. It's a known effect that is on plan for the deck that you're playing it in.
Yeah.
So I think these are playable. And the mana early isn't that bad because if you're thinking that preordain, if you remember that preordain costs a mana. But the problem is that the delve mechanic undoes that cost. All right. So yeah, Shatterscale Smashing, right? It's better. It takes it to the next level because it's the mana early is better. It can come into play untapped at the cost of 3 life. You've got the option of tap or untapped land. And yeah, provided the business late is on plan and sufficiently efficient in terms of mana costs and effects, it's good. I think this card's good. I'd play this in a burn deck and all sorts of other decks.
It is good. Yeah. On the other end of it, it's good.
Yeah. now Timeless Dragon and Ruin Grinder, right? They provide mana early as well because you can cycle for 2 mana. You can tutor up your plains or your mountain. Okay. But that early mana is bad.
Yeah. Having to pay 2 is not.
2 is a lot. Good. Yeah. But the business late is better. Okay. You're getting. And the nice thing about Timeless Dragon is you get both. You get the you do get this plane cycling, and then you get the creature. It's not one or the other.
Yeah,
I think with Ruin Grinder, it's one or the other.
I think Timeless Dragon, like, it fills the 2, the 4, and the 5 slot. The variable mana cost is good as well.
Yeah,
I think it gives you a lot of options. Yeah,
exactly. And that's what we're talking about: getting options. And conceptually, I like the design of these cards in ways that give you options and mana early business late, like cantrips, in just non-standard ways. So if Wizards keeps printing these, you're going to be able to access the boon and benefit of cantrips in different ways. Yeah. And I think you need to be on the lookout for that. And the problem is are they just costed well enough? Are they sufficiently efficient? Sometimes they aren't. And sometimes they get close, or they are.
Yeah. I find, like, if I see a little 2 or anything more in that cycling ability, I start, I balk at it. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah.
So whenever I see one that's got 1, it's like, ooh, that seems like it could be worth looking at. You know?
Yeah, well,
so
I was going to
look out for that.
Yeah. Well, on your initial definition of a cantrip, any car that cycles for 1 mana is a cantrip.
Hmm.
That's
probably true.
Well, it replaces itself and it's cheap at a cheap cost. But the problem is you don't just want to be cycling. You want to get some incidental effect stapled onto it.
Yeah, otherwise, it's a sensor size cycles for 1, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So Sar was always pretty big on that. I don't know if he's playing it anymore, but
yeah.
He liked it.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, Mind Stone, that's mana early business late in the right artifact deck. Maze Mind Tome is like a expensive preordain.
Yeah.
Now Smuggler's Copter is like, it's like Faithless Looting. It gives you that. It's selection through looting or hand fixing through looting, drawing and discarding. But it's in a way that arguably doesn't put you down on cards because you get this vehicle that you can use. I think it's powerful in the right deck. And this is something we haven't talked about, like, and I'm pushing it here. Like, this is more like Howling Mine and Dark Confidant. They're not really, they're more comparable to A-Call than Brainstorm or whatever, because they're generating card advantage. They're giving you options through drawing more cards. Yeah, but so if you can't find cantrip functional equivalents in your deck, then just keep drawing cards, basically. it's the best way to get options, like, if you can.
Yeah, Howling Mine's super, like, a bit riskier. Dark Confident, you got the life loss, whereas giving your opponent additional resources. But you're playing some strategies where you can tap your own Howling Mine, turn it off your opponent.
Yeah, I'm not saying these cards are good. I'm just saying these.
Oh, Dark Confident's good.
Yeah.
It's real good.
But I'm just saying how they function, where they.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
How they can function. Yeah. And so you just be on the lookout for these types of effects and how they can improve your deck. Like Expedition Map, it's mana early business late. Just by virtue of being a tutor, like, any cheap tutor can probably fulfill the role of a cantrip. A cantrip is kind of like a bad tutor. It's just a very small tutor.
Yeah.
Your selection, it doesn't give you tutoring. So like one, this one or that one or whatever. But imagine if, you know, they, instead of preordained, they printed, you know, one black, go and get any card and put it in your hand. Like, oh, that's better. Yeah. Well, that's better than a can. That's better than a can.
Well, it's better than demonic tutor, right?
So, yeah. I'm just saying, like multiple
points.
I'm just saying my point is like tutoring, if you can find an efficiently costed tutor that fits your plan, it can kind of function equivalent as a cantrip, provided it can give you mana early enough. Expedition map is, it can just do it because you can go and get Misha's Workshop or Tolarian Academy or whatever and get the mana back that you've put into it. But yeah, like maybe Sylvan Scrying is similar. Especially if you can Sylvan Scry for like a land that's business late. Like you've got to be able to tutor up for mana early, business late. So that might be, the business late might be Seiju or Urza Saga or Ivergen or whatever. All right, and these last ones are like Witching Well. That's, it's giving you like selection on the entry and then like card advantage on the backside. It's just expensive, that's all, to get the cards out of it. But it does function as a cantrip if you can ever cash it in.
That's been seeing plenty of play, like in Tolarian Academy and Tinker with.
Yeah, it's surprising. I didn't think it was good at first, but then having played with it a bit, and Lachlan Saunders played it a bit as well, I think it is good. And here's a new one as well. This is the last one I'll finish on. It's this interesting kind of fringy card, like the Moonsnare Prototype. If you have another artifact on the board, Mishra's Bauble or whatever it is, ideally Halimine, you can like tap that and this to get a mana, the mana early. Yeah. It's quite cheap. So it can function as like half a Llanowar Elf. You need to have something else to empower it. But it's also business late. It's not just that mana early. You can channel it to like bounce a card.
Oh,
yeah. So I just think that's, I'm not saying it's good or powerful, but I'm just saying it fits this criterion of like mana early, business late, which once you start to fill your deck with these things, you're going to have a lot of options.
Yeah,
and you can play these things alongside cantrips as well, but yeah, I think the more you can get you can get these effects, the more options you're going to have, and the more you're going to be able to keep up with blue decks. Yeah, that's my thesis. Yeah.
No, it's interesting.
Like, yeah.
They're obviously not as powerful as the one mana blue, like core ones, but there are options out there, I guess, is the thing that people can play around with, and like, you know,
and they might get more efficient.
They
might get more efficient
like that. Yeah.
No, what do you say, Dan? Sorry.
I was going to say, like, Highlander is not the kind of format that just that's kind of like solved as quickly as other formats. So there's heaps of design space that's still available. So maybe people can sort of make these kinds of cards work.
You can't play four preordains. You got to go elsewhere. And if you're not playing blue, then you need to think about how you're getting options. I think as these cards keep getting printed and they become more efficient, they're going to be more attractive, and they're going to be able to, non-blue decks are going to be able to compete more consistently and reliably with blue decks. That's my hope. Especially cards like Shadow Skull Smashing, like the lands, modal lands one side and spell the other, which Mistress, you know, Factory was the first one, arguably. I mean, you've got heaps of utility lands, Wandering Fumarole. It's just a matter of how efficient are they? How good is the front? How good is the mana side? How good is the business side? But yeah, like Shadow Cell Smashing is pushing it. It's getting up, and you know, Besageu is really pushing it. You know what I mean? And hopefully,
yeah, I think you're right. I think you're
pushing
right.
That.
Yeah, because like when you test against, like if you're playing on blue deck, you know there's this point in the mid game where the dust settles, And yeah, like I was saying before, like the blue player has the advantage then, like because of the selection, or is you're more likely to rip lands off the top. And so the extent to which they turn lands into business, you know, can help the non-blue deck. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, let's wrap it up. Do you want any final sentiments about cantrips?
No. I don't think so. I think we've probably covered most of the ground. I still don't know what the answer is for how many. I think probably practical wisdom is like 8 is kind of getting there. Like you can get to a point where you've got too much air in your deck and you're just losing tempo. You're just cantripping into more cantrips. So you just have to test your way through all of that. And it really depends on how, to what extent your deck values digging for particular things. You probably have more cantrips in your combo decks and things like that than others. But yeah, it's a matter of working your way through.
Well, I'm looking at your deck now. So I'm just going to see how many you got. You got one, Bun and Harvest, Brainstorm.
Yep.
Mental Note, Preordain, Ponder.
5, 6.
And Thought Scour. That's 6.
Yep.
Yeah. So you overshot with 8.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because I could turn the Noble Hierarch and the Ignoble Hierarch into another 2. So there's like the, there's that number of proactive 1-mana spells. And in the end, that was the mix that I landed on. You'll see that like I've paid a lot of attention to having 9 proactive 1-mana plays as well, because I really want to be tapping out in this list. And then using my counter magic late. So I don't sort of count when I'm looking at that. I don't count things like Swords to Plowshares as a turn 1 play. Even though it might be.
Yeah. But I just think it's interesting. Like, so for your deck, the power level of the cantrips has stopped at like Thought Scour, Mental Note. And at that point, the mana dorks have become better, like better than the next cantrip.
I think so.
Yeah, or not in abstract, but relative to your plan in terms of Euro and everything else.
Like look at how greedy it is. Like, there's something you get from that. As I trimmed dork after dork, that's kind of where I got to.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we hope you've enjoyed today's chat and made you think a bit about cantrips, what their role is, how you can fill your deck with cantrips, how you can fill your deck with cards that aren't cantrips but function comparably. And I think next time we're going to talk about counter magic as well.
Yeah, cool.
All right. See you then.
Cool. Thanks, Drew. See you.
Yeah.